Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Erev Tov, for those in Israel. Welcome to part two of our Torah in Motion series on Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, given by Rabbi Alex Israel. A pleasure to welcome him back after the wonderful class last week. We want to thank, again, the Gantz Family Foundation for their sponsorship of the series, and want to welcome everybody, and hopefully you can join us this class, other classes. And I'll just make mention right now, we have in 2 weeks from yesterday, we have our 13th annual medical ethics, conference. Is really, a fantastic conference with some of the top speakers in the world. You can take a look on the website. We used to do it, of course, live, but last year and this year, of course, we're doing it online. So that's two Sundays, the 11th of July, and all our other programs are on the website. And with that announcement, Bakasha, Rabbi Israel, we look forward to class number two.
Okay, so hello everybody. Good evening from Israel, and good afternoon to all of you in Toronto or wherever you are in the world. I hope that everybody's keeping safe and doing everything you're meant to be doing within the regulations. Really welcome. Last week we had an introduction to Rabbi Sacks, and I tried to tell some anecdotes in order to give everybody a sense of the man he was. And today we're going to dive in to the deep end. We're going to take a look at this book, which is called The Dignity of Difference. Can you see it? The Dignity of Difference. And the reason why I've chosen this book is because I think it is to talk about this week is, well, this is the book that got Rabbi Sacks into the most trouble, into real hot water. So much so that he had to withdraw this edition of the book that I've been holding in my hand, the first edition, and come out with a second, let's call it a censored edition, because rabbis in the UK, including members of the Beit Din, and many, many of his rabbanim, felt that the book that he had written contained heresy. So if you wanted a sort of tantalizing introduction, that's it. And what I want to do is I want to learn with you the central thesis of this book. And we're going to go through and understand the central thesis. Then we're going to indeed try and understand what the controversy was about. Is what he did, what he wrote, is it indeed heretical? Why do people think it was heretical, et cetera, et cetera. And then we're going to examine the theology of the book and what it might have meant in other spheres. So let's start at the very beginning. This book, The Dignity of Difference, was published a year after the fall of the World Trade Center. This is Rabbi Sacks' response to 9/11. And when you look at the book, well, Rabbi Sacks says very clearly, and I'm even quoting from an interview with him as I speak, he says, 9/11 shook all of us, shook the whole world. One thing happened was the World Economic Forum that's normally held in Davos was held that year in January 2002 in New York. And he says the Archbishop of Canterbury was there, the Chief Rabbi of Israel was there, gurus from India, imams and so on. We all gave prayers at Ground Zero. But standing there at Ground Zero and seeing the sheer enormity of what happened there, just 3 months later, right? It happened in September. This was January. Left a huge impact on me. And I suddenly realized here is religion as hate. And here we are standing with the Archbishop of Canterbury, with imams, with gurus. And he set himself to write a book that would be published. And it was on the first anniversary of 9/11, on the 11th of September, 2002. And he said, I must publish a book and it must be the strongest possible statement that I can make. The strongest possible statement about what religion can be. And that it can be a religion of love and not a religion of hate. That's quite a tall order to take on. Later on, Rabbi Sacks published another book in 2015, if I'm not mistaken, 2015. And it's called Not in God's Name, Not in God's Name. And that was a follow-on to this, which is also about the fact that religion should be a force for good in the world, for understanding, for tolerance. And so I want to, that is the stated aim of this book, to try and understand that religion should not be a force for hate. Now, I want to, before I even dive in, before I open the source sheet, which I'm going to share with you in just 1 minute, I would like to say something else. And that is this. Last time I suggested that Rabbi Sacks, everything he does is on a double track. One message is an internal message to the Jewish people, and one message is a message to the world. And this will really provide some of the fundamental understanding of this theology. However, there is not only a message here for the world, there is also a very deep message for the Jewish people. And we're going to come back to that in a very short amount of time. At the end of the class, that's what we're going to end with. So let me share my sheet and source sheet. I hope you were able to find it on the website. If you aren't, it will be posted. And I hope people
posted it already. I posted it in the chat box already.
Great, fantastic. So I'm going to be using, by the way, Rabbi Sacks, as I said, wrote this in 2002. You can see here, The Dignity of Difference, 2002. However, as you will see later on in the sheet, these ideas were already in some of his earliest books. Two of these books, The Persistence of Faith, which he published in 1991, and this book, Crisis and Covenant, which he published in 1992, already the central thesis is already there. Let's begin, and I'm going to be using two major texts. One is a lecture to the Council of Christians and Jews, and I've given you the URL there. You can look up the lecture. And the other one is the book itself, where I've given page numbers. It's in the book, The Dignity of Difference, and I'm quoting from the first edition, where there are differences between the first and second edition. You will see it in the footnotes. We'll get there. Let's begin. And I'm taking it from the top here. Sorry, 1 minute. Okay, here we go. He says, if religion is the problem, let religion be the solution. The question I set myself is, can we find, especially within the three Abrahamic monotheisms, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, a road to tolerance, a road to a coexistence, or better still, a respect for difference? That is the path I sought to explore in my book, The Dignity of Difference. So that is what he says was the purpose of the book. Again, I do want to stress, in other lectures, he gave a different explanation of the book for Jewish audiences, and we'll talk about that soon. Okay, how are we going to express the problem? Let me read a little bit with him. The problem. This is going to be stage A in the argument. One belief, more than any other, is responsible for the slaughter of individuals on the altars of great historical ideals. It is belief that those who do not share my faith or my race or my ideology do not share my humanity. At best, they are second-class citizens. At worst, they forfeit the sanctity of life itself. Notice, I have to say, that Rabbi Sacks is not saying this is only a Jewish problem. This is going to be a problem of any thought system that says that I have the truth and everybody else should be damned, or anybody else is subhuman, or anybody else is an infidel or a heretic. They are the saved, the unbelievers, the infidel, the unredeemed. They stand outside my circle of salvation. If faith is what makes us human, then those who do not share my faith are less than fully human. From this equation flowed the Crusades, the Inquisitions, the Jihads, the pogroms, the blood of human sacrifices throughout the age. From it substituting race for faith ultimately came the Holocaust. I used to think, says Rabbi Sacks, that the Holocaust has cured us of this idea that it was impossible not to hear from the ghosts of Auschwitz the cry, never again. Now I'm not so sure. In other words, after 9/11, he's not so sure. I've come increasingly to view that if we do not, like Yaakov, wrestle with the dark angel of nature and beliefs that there will be other tragedies. In Rwanda, Cambodia, and the Balkans, there already have been, and there will be more. This is the greatest religious challenge of all, and much will depend on whether we are equal to it. It is a challenge posed in the Bible's opening chapters. The first recorded act of religious worship leads directly to the first murder, the first fratricide. Two people bring an offering to God. The name of one is Abel, the other is Cain. I read this story as a clear and fateful warning at the very beginning of the Book of Books, that just as there is a road from faith to redemption, so there is direct path from religion to violence. What is it that leads people to shed blood in the name of God? There is one answer with which we are familiar. Religion is about identity, and identity excludes. For every we, there is a them. Today, we are inclined to see resurgent tribalism as the great danger of our fragmented world. It is, but it is not the only danger. The paradox is that the very thing we take to be the antithesis of tribalism, universalism, could also be deeply threatening. Okay, you know what? Let me stop for a second. So what's Rabbi Sacks saying? Rabbi Sacks is saying, and maybe it's quite an admission for a rabbi to make, for a man of religion, for a man of the cloth to make, is that religion can sometimes and has a propensity to cause violence. It already starts with Cain and Hevel, where Cain and Hevel murder on the basis of religion. And now he's going to get here at the bottom of page one, he's going to get into another interesting argument, which is that we live in a globalized world. We today talk about universal truths. The internet has let us all be connected to one another. And he says, and here, if you're not sure where exactly I am on the sheets, I will highlight. Universalism can also be deeply threatening and may be equally inadequate as an account of human situation. A global culture is a universal culture. And universal cultures, though they have brought great good, have also done immense harm. They see as the basis of humanity the fact that we are all ultimately the same. We are vulnerable, we embody creatures, we hunger, thirst, fear, and pain, we reason, hope, dream, and aspire. These things are true and important, but we are also different. Each landscape, language, culture, community is unique. Our very dignity as persons is rooted in the fact that none of us is like the other. Okay, so what Rabbi Sacks is already establishing at the start is the fact that religion can be a force for violence because we have a we. We look at ourselves as the Christians, and therefore we will slaughter the heretics with the Muslims, and therefore we'll slaughter the infidels. This week, we are reading Parashat Pinchas, which is a story about Heshivat Kinati, that he has the zeal, an act of religious violence, and I think it raises the question for us. When is religious violence legitimate and when is it illegitimate? So that's the first thing. And the second thing that Rabbi Sacks, point two, in a secular guise, it's the same thing. If you're not communist, right, then you have to be murdered. If you're not, don't agree with Nazi ideology or you don't belong to the Aryan race, you are the them, you are subhuman, you have no right to exist. However, we might think in the universal world, this is great, but he says there's a danger in the universal world that it doesn't allow for difference. Okay, let's keep moving on. And I want to build up Rabbi Sacks' argument piece by piece. And this is where he stated the problem. Let's see how he continues. He has a whole section, page 49 in the book, called Exercising Plato's Ghost. And let me explain what he means by Plato's ghost. I'm sure many of you know a little bit about Plato. Plato, for example, said that there are lots of tables in the world. There are round tables, there are work tables, there are coffee tables, there are garden tables, there are dining room tables, there are lots of different tables. But ultimately, they all relate to a Platonic table. There is a concept of a table, of a bed, of a chair, of a tree, of what you might see. In other words, there is an ideal everything. Let's read the quote. If you seek truth, Aristotle, do not look down to this world that surrounds us, empirical reality with its messy and chaotic particulars. Look up to heaven and the world of forms, says Plato, for it is there you will find the true essence and the nature of things. There, in place of particularity and conflict, you'll find unity and harmony. Again, I'll read Rabbi Sacks, top of page two. In the world of ideas, difference is resolved into sameness. In other words, We see lots of different tables. There is a modern style table and a classic mahogany table. There is a stone table and what have you. But in the ultimate world of ideas, difference is resolved into sameness. Particulars give way to universals. The world in we see, in which we move and live, he argued in the Republic, in the famous parable of the cave, is mere play of shadows. The true essence of things is not matter, but form. Ideas, not their concrete embodiment in the world of the senses. This is where trees become treeness, men become man, and apparent truths coalesce into truth with a capital T. And he says, it is a wondrous dream, that of Plato, and one that has never ceased to appeal to his philosophical and religious heirs. The dream of the reason, a world of order set against the chaos of life. Life is messy, right? And what do we want beyond an ordered world? I want to know, what is the emet? Tell me exactly what to do. You know, some people, they want to refer to the halakha. What does the halakha say? And the truth is, when you open the books of halakha, you discover there are 15 opinions. I remember once we were in yeshiva and we were sitting at the lunch table in the lunchroom of yeshiva. And they had served chicken soup with noodles. What could be more Jewish than chicken soup with noodles? Now, the question came up for people who had not made hamotzi, right? The question was, what should be the bracha on chicken soup with noodles? One person said, well, the chicken soup is the main thing and the noodles are just the accoutrements. So I'm going to make a shahakol. The other one said, no. You don't understand. Whenever there's a mazonot, you should make mazonot. So make mazonot on the noodles are made out of flour. They should be mazonot. The other one said, no, the chicken soup is distinct and the noodles are distinct. I'm going to make a mazonos on the noodles and a shahakol on the soup. And then the fourth guy at the table turns around and says, oh gosh, I can't deal with all of this doubt. I'm going to go and wash and then I won't have to worry about what bracha to make. Right? One of the boys was so disturbed by this particular incident, he went to the Bet Midrash and spent the whole of the rest of his lunch break investigating. And indeed, he found in the books of halacha that all four opinions were represented. Some people search for the halacha, but in fact, this is, you know, four opinions. So one of the guys decided to go to our Rosh Yeshiva, our esteemed Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Lichtenstein, and he said, how can you have this? One bowl of chicken soup and noodles and four opinions, right? This is a theological problem. And Rav Lichtenstein, in his typical way, say, well, you could look at it as a problem, or you could look at it as a beautiful thing, the multiplicity of views that halacha allows. That's the question, right? Some people yearn for the clarity that one answer gives, and other people revel in the multiplicity. And Rabbi Sachs is saying that Plato really yearned. He found this world very messy, and he yearned for a single truth. And Rabbi Sachs says that we have to excise the ghost of Plato, that this yearning for this clarity, this yearning for this truth, can become the source of tremendous evil and tremendous problems. And he notices here something really remarkable. And here I'm going to go into already section C on your sheet, where Rabbi Sachs starts looking at Sefer Bereishit. It's very interesting if we're talking about Rabbi Sachs as a thinker. Rabbi Sachs frequently will appeal way more to Tanakh than he does to rabbinic sources. I'm not quite sure what to make of that. I have some thoughts on the topic, but we won't go into that now. I'm just going to note that down. And Rabbi Sachs is very interested. Again, what's he set up? That we are looking, we are a world of now which is globalized. We're a universal world. There are people looking for a single truth. And yet, what do we do with the fact that we're different religions? So where does he go? He goes to Sefer Bereishit and he notes something really interesting. He says, think about Bereishit. Think about the Torah as a whole. The Torah is the book of the Jewish people. If you think about it, quite near the beginning, we meet Abraham. We learn about the first family, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef, the Jewish people who were given the promise of a land. and they are in slavery and they make their way to the land. Almost all the Torah is about the Jewish people. So I would say it's a book about the Jewish people and the laws they're given. But here's a surprise. The first 11 chapters don't talk about the Jewish people at all. They talk about all of humanity. The first 11 chapters are a manifest about civilization as a whole. They are, in their scope, universal. What do you make of that? The fact that the world, God originally talks to Adam, who's not Jewish. And then we move on and we talk about the flood, and we talk about the covenant with Noah and Bnei Noah. And Bnei Noah refers to all of civilization. And then forward to the development of what we call the 70 nations, chapter 10, and then chapter 11, the story of the Tower of Babel. And only in chapter 12 do we meet Abraham, and Abraham is given this special mandate from God. Why does the Torah begin on a universal scope and then filter in to a particularistic, to a notion of a people, a single people? What's going on here? So let's read a little bit together with Rabbi Sacks and see what he has to say about this. Here we go. I'm on page 2, number C, from universalism to particularism. Civilization is a journey from the particular to the universal. He's talking about the development of civilization. As soon as we see how in Western thought civilization is a journey from the particular to the universal, we begin to realize what is so radical about the philosophy of the book of Genesis. Genesis begins with the universal, with Adam and Eve and humanity as a whole, and it's from there that it moves to the particular, to Abraham and Sarah and their children. It is exact opposite movement of Platonic thought. It's what makes Genesis 1 Western civilization's great counter-Platonic narrative. Isn't that a lovely phrase? The question is why, and the obvious place to look is the answer, is in the passage immediately before God's call to Abraham to leave his land, his birthplace. What precedes the passage is Genesis 11, the story of the Tower of Babel. In other words, what Rabbi Sacks is doing is he says, if you want to understand why God decides to abandon universalism and choose a particular people, well, let's look what went wrong. What went wrong was the Tower of Babel. Well, let's take a look at the Tower of Babel. And he focuses on one particular phrase. The whole world was one language and shared vocabulary. And he's going to read the book, Tower of Babel, as in the guise of the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. And here's the way he summarizes what he says. We're going to read Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin in a second, in Ha'amik Davar. But he says, Bavel was the first totalitarianism. It was the first place that had no room for difference. Let's take a look at what he's referring to. How is he reading Migdal Bavel? So if you see on your sheet, you see the parsha there. Notice how it begins. Everyone, v'hikola aretz, everybody on earth had Safa achat, a single language, udvarim achadim, and singular ideas, right? The same sort of ideology, the same mindset. In the translation I've given you here, which I can't remember where it comes from, it might be the JPS, it's the same language and the same words, but because davar can mean a word or a thing. But really, of course, they all have the same language. That's the whole drama, but it seems like they also thought together. And if you read what they do is, Vahiban Osam Mikedem, they travel from the east and they find a valley and they dwell there. It seems like they want to dwell together. And notice how they talk, verse 3. And they one said to the other, Vayomru Ishareu, Hava Anil Banala Veinim, let's make bricks. And in the next verse, verse 4, they say, Hava Nivne Lanu Ir. Note, do you see the unity? Hava Anil Banala Veinim, let's do this. And in the next verse, let's make a city. Hava Nivne Lanu Ir, let's build a city. Umigdal and a tower, Viroshoba Shamayim, and let us make its head in the heavens, its top in the sky, Venasilanu Shem, we will make a name for ourselves, Pen Nafutz al Panei Kol Haaretz, lest we be scattered. This is a unified society, a society which wants to has the same language, a singular idea. And when God sees it, it says, verse 5, the Lord came down to look at the city and tower that man had built. And the Lord said, if They are one people, one language for all. And this is how they begin to act. Then nothing they conspire will be out of their reach. Let us go down and confound their speech. They won't understand each other's speech. And once they can't understand each other's speech, right, what happens? They get scattered over the face of the whole earth. What's happening here? Let's take a look at the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Lozhin. He has a parish called Hamek Davar. And interestingly enough, his son became one of the leaders of religious Zionism, changed his name from Berlin to Bar Ilan. And Rav Meir Bar Ilan is who Bar Ilan University is named after. Let's take a look at his reading. It's a very radical reading. And the Netziv lived at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. The reason why I'm mentioning that is because it's amazing how prescient this is as to the dangers of the totalitarianisms of the 20th century. Let's take a look. What does it mean, and we will make ourselves a name? What do they need a tower for? Why do they need a tower? So, of course, it expresses hubris. It expresses a desire to create some monument to their society. But that's not how the Netziv reads it. He says, people were set up I'm going to read in English, please excuse me, we just don't have time. People were set up to watch and be in charge of the thing. They were army chiefs in charge of punishing those who would cross. If this was not the case, there would be no need for the tower. And all this was due to the suspicion lest we be scattered over the face of the earth. However, says the Netziv, we must understand why they feared that someone might leave to another land. And it must be understood that this related to the uniformity that was among them. And here's the critical phrase, since the opinions of people are not identical, they feared that people might abandon this philosophy and adopt another. Therefore, they sought to ensure that no one would leave their society. And anyone who veered from this uniformity was judged with the punishment of being burnt, just as they did to our Avram Avinu. And the same words can also be seen as the fact that they would kill anybody who did not think like them. Says Rabbi Sacks, we have a situation in which society was so unified, it wanted to enforce its unity by force. The tower was a secret watchtower with the KGB or what have you, the secret police there. They were so afraid that somebody would develop a different ideology, a different way of living, a different way of thinking, that they decided they would spy on everybody. They would enforce their way of living. Nobody was allowed to think differently. Nobody was allowed to live differently. What God does is he changes their language. Language is always the key to creation in Sefer Bereshit. God creates through language. God, relationships are created through language. And once language changes, now with different languages, there's a multiplicity of cultures. And suddenly what happens? Once we have different cultures, God says, I've got a message for a particular culture, and that's the book of the Torah. But that only happens after we realize that a uniform world cannot work. Let's read it with Rabbi Sacks. Letter D. I define religious fundamentalism as the attempt to impose a single truth on a plural world. And that is why God responds to Babel by creating a multiplicity of languages and helps a multiplicity of cultures and civilizations. That is why the key movement of the Bible is from universality to particularity, against Plato. That is why the beating heart of monotheism is the miracle, that unity up there, Hashem Echad, creates diversity down here. And the rabbis in the second century, in the document we call the Mishnah, chapter 4 of Sanhedrin, said so beautifully, when a human being mints many coins in the same mint, they all come out exactly the same. But God makes every human being in the same mint, in the same image, his image, and we all come out different. We're B'Tzelem Elokim, and therefore we're different. And that is the point the Bible is making. If we read the Mosaic books carefully, we find a very strange phenomenon. I'm sure you know the biblical command, love your neighbor as yourself. It appears how many times in the Hebrew Bible? It appears once. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18. The rabbis were very struck by the facts, and they went through and counted them. And I must tell you, I've counted them, and I got the same answer. The Bible commands us in one place to love our neighbor, but in 36 places to love the stranger. Why does it tell us 36 times to love the stranger? Because it's much harder to love a stranger than your neighbor. And now we understand why immediately after Genesis 11, the story of Babel and the attempt to impose an artificial unity on human diversity comes the call to Avraham. Avraham, leave your birthplace, leave your father's house, leave all the places where everyone is like you and travel to an unknown destination. Become a stranger in a strange land. Go and live a life that is different from the peoples around you, different from the way Mesopotamians live, different from the way Egyptians live, different from the way your neighbors, the Canaanites and Hittites live. Go and be different. Why did God tell Abraham to be different? To teach all humanity the dignity of difference. And friends, we know, thanks to the entire environmental movement, that our entire ecology depends on biodiversity. And any loss of that diversity can have incalculable consequences. Cut down the rainforest and you get global warming. So this is quite an argument. Rabbi Sacks is saying that whereas Plato tried to get us to move from the messiness of diversity to unity, and ultimately we yearn for a single truth, the Torah begins with a single society which tries to unify itself more and more and more. And God says, I don't want it. I want plurality. And the Torah is telling Avram, Lech lecha me'artzecha, go away from those big societies which impose uniformity. Avram, by the way, came from Bavel. There are midrashim, indeed, that he was wandering around Migdal Bavel, and from there he was called. And now Avraham creates a new way. There is one God, but there are many, many ways to live in this. As many nations, you know, we talk about 70 nations and we talk about 70 tongues. So every language reflects a different way of looking into the world. So now I want to read the radical piece of Rabbi Sacks that he got into some hot water for. And that's why I put here in F, Rabbi Sacks' Radical Theology, Dignity of Difference, page 55. And look at this. The radical transcendence of God in the Hebrew Bible means nothing more or less that there is a difference between God and religion. God is universal. Religions are particular. Religion is the translation of God into a particular language and thus into the life of a group, a nation, a community of faith. In other words, there's Hashem, but Judaism is our particular language, our particular translation of the God idea into the story of our nation. And now listen to this, and I bolded this because this was got people really upset. In the course of history, God has spoken to mankind in many languages, through Judaism to Jews, Christianity to Christians, Islam to Muslims. Only such a God is truly transcendental, greater not only than the natural universe, but also the spiritual universe articulated in any single faith, any specific language of human sensibility. How could a sacred text convey such an idea? It would declare that God is the God of all humanity, but no single faith is or should be the faith of all humanity. Only such a narrative would lead us to see the presence of God in people of other faiths. Only such a worldview could reconcile the particularity of cultures with the universality of the human condition. This means that religious truth is not universal. What it does not mean is that it's relative. Now, of course, this idea that, you know, God has spoken through Judaism to Jews, Christianity to Christians, Islam to Muslims, sounds like that Hashem revealed himself through Christianity, revealed himself through Islam. And if you look at the bottom of the page, right, you'll see the revised edition. He changed this and he said, as Jews, here we go. As Jews, we believe that God has made a covenant with a singular people, that's us, but that does not exclude the possibility of other people's cultures and faiths finding their own relationship with God within the shared frame of the Noahide laws. These laws constitute, as it were, the depth grammar of the human experience of the divine, of what it is to see the world as God's work and the humanity as God's image. God is the God of all humanity, but between Babel and the end of days, no single faith is the faith of all humanity. Notice how he's changed here. He didn't lead to indicate that maybe God had spoken to Jesus or to Muhammad. He's rather saying that there is a truth that everybody lives out through the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. And that means that Jews have a certain truth, but other people have another way to go. Let's just read a bit more, and then we'll try and deal with some of the scandal. He says here, I'm reading here, there is a difference all too often ignored between absoluteness and universality. I have an By the way, this is a very beautiful, beautiful explanation. I have an absolute obligation to my child, but it's not a universal one. In other words, my family is my family. My parents, I have the ultimate regard for. My children, I have ultimate responsibility for. And everybody has a parent and everybody has a child, hopefully. But he says, it's not your children. I have a responsibility to my children. So now compare that to religions, right? I'll read it again. There's a difference all too often ignored between absoluteness and universality. I have an absolute obligation to my child, but it's not a universal one. Indeed, it's precisely this non-universality, this particularity that constitutes parenthood and the ability to feel a bond with this child, not to all children indiscriminately. That's what makes love, love. Not a generalized affection for all persons of such and such type, but a particular attachment to this person in his or her uniqueness. So we passionately believe in our Judaism, aware that other people passionately believe in their religions. And let me just give you another way of understanding this. Look at the page 56. The God of Abraham teaches humanity a more complex truth than simple oppositions. For example, particular and universal, individual and state, tribe and humanity allow. We are particular and universal, the same. We're all human and different human beings as such, but also members of this family, this community, that history, that heritage. And now here's a critical thing which we'll come to at the end. Our particularity is our window onto universality, just as our language is the only way we have understanding the world we share with speakers of other languages. Wow. Let me try and explain that. I was brought up speaking English, maybe speaking English and Hebrew. Somebody else is brought up speaking Chinese. Other people are brought up speaking Arabic or Spanish or French. Now, what does that mean? You know, sometimes language creates perceptions, right? There are things within our language that will mean I experience the world differently. So I can understand the world in general, but I experience it through the prism of the culture, the language that I brought up in. In other words, we can only know the world through our own particularity, through our own language or through our own religion. Through my understanding of religion, I can understand the world, and everybody else is that way. God no more wants all faiths and cultures to be the same than loving parents want his or her children to be the same. Again, I'll finish one last idea. I'm highlighting it. At the beating heart of monotheism is that God is greater than religion. He's only partially comprehended by any faith. He is my God, but he's also your God. He's on my side, but also on your side. He exists not only in my faith, but also in yours. What would faith be like? It would be like being secure in one's home, yet moved by the beauty of foreign places, knowing somebody else's home, not mine, but still part of the glory of the world that is ours. So this is what Rabbi Sacks wrote, and this is his understanding. His understanding is that Hashem is Hashem of all the world, but we have a particular religion. But we should understand that everybody's got their own language. Everybody's got their own religion. And just like we value religion for giving us so many blessings, of helping us understand so many things, other people also have religions. Now, as I say, this created a huge scandal in England, and maybe what the world over. This is from The Guardian reporting about this. I could have brought from the Jewish Chronicle, but this was a good summary. He said, Rabbi Sacks was accused for suggesting that no religion has a monopoly of truth. Rabbi Elchanan Halpin, who was the head of the sort of Eda Charedis, the ultra-Orthodox wing in England, said that Dr. Sacks, wouldn't name him as a rabbi, must not only make atonement for his sin, but ensure the recall of all copies of his book, The Dignity of Difference, so they could be destroyed. Right? Wow. And what appears to have caused outrage is the book suggesting that religions have something to learn from one another and God's message may not have been exclusive to one group. And they quote this line. The statement came as the London Beit Din, the religious court, gave a qualified welcome to Dr. Sacks' promise to remove ambiguities from the book when it's republished. The Beit Din said that the book was open to an interpretation that is inconsistent with basic Jewish beliefs. In other words, the Beit Din, who were Rabbi Sacks' Beit Din, also said they came out defending Rabbi Sacks, but this notion was that he had to correct the book. And Rabbi Sacks promised to rewrite sections of the book. In future editions, I will restate and reaffirm these points in less ambiguous phraseology. And indeed, he did. Some people will, again, here's the interesting thing. In later interviews, he said he didn't retract anything he wrote in the book, and he thought what he wrote in the book was correct. However, in order that the book should be published and not, you know, and him not being accused of heresy, because I think his chief rabbinate was really in peril, he had to change various different phrases, okay? And let's read what Rabbi Sacks writes at the preface to the second revised edition. He says, the first edition, I'm on page, sorry, 1 minute, page six. The first edition of the book generated controversy within the Jewish community, some maintaining that certain passages could be understood in ways incompatible with Jewish belief. I believed I had guarded against that possibility of making it clear in the prologue that I was writing as an Orthodox Jew, implying that my interpretation, any interpretation incompatible with the classic tenets of Jewish faith, was a misinterpretation. In the event, the caveat proved insufficient. Certain passages, especially in chapter 3, were misunderstood. I therefore decided to restate them in less problematic terms. Since the core argument of the book is simple and in Jewish terms uncontroversial, I've redrafted it in such a way as to circumnavigate all debated issues unrelated to the main thesis. In other words, what Rabbi Sacks says, the central thesis he believed in, and if there are a few controversial phrases, take them out. And that's indeed what he did. And now, how did Rabbi Sacks, now what I want to try and look at in the next sort of 20 minutes that we have together is, number one, is indeed Rabbi Sacks's theology here so radical? Is it contingent with, you know, regular Orthodox belief? And should the book have been banned? And how did Rabbi Sacks look at this? By the way, let me just let me stop the share for a second. And let me just say to you that it's really fascinating that Rabbi Sacks spoke about in an interview later on. He says, and I quote from him, it's not on your sheet, I'm sorry. He says, I made two phone calls to rabbis senior than me, older than me, and wider than me. And I've got to tell you, I'm really curious who they were. He says, one in Israel and one in America. They both said yes. I heard support from them. I realized I was fine. And he says this piece of wisdom when he says, I had two friends say, you're okay. And I was able to get through the rest. And in the end, it turned out to be minor. He says, so, and even says, what happens when you're in a situation in which you've done something that has generated widespread disapproval? How do you deal with that? I thought about this long and hard, and eventually I came up with a principle which has been a lifesaver to me and which makes a good deal of sense. It says, win the respect of people you respect and forget about the rest, which is fascinating, really fascinating that that is the way he looks at this situation. He went and spoke. I can only assume that the one in Israel was his teacher, Rav Rabinovich. I'm really very curious as to who the person he took advice with in the United States was. I have no clue who it would be. But whichever way, he got backing from two people that he respected, and that gave him the backbone to carry on and not to, so to speak, retract. I'm sorry that I'm not relating to the chat. Simply, I'm very bad at doing two things at once. I can't follow the discussion on both tracks. I'll look at it at the end of the class and try and relate to some of the comments. So please, please excuse me. One response was from Professor Mark Shapiro. And Mark Shapiro himself has a lovely history of talking about heresy because he wrote a long article, which later became a book, about the Rambam, and spoke about how the Rambam himself had codified the 13 principles of faith, but that there was much greater leeway, right, on the 13 principles of faith, and people didn't like his article. Mark Shapiro, Professor Mark Shapiro from Scranton University, I think, is an amazing scholar. I think he's lectured for Torah in Motion more than once, and encyclopedic knowledge, and who's better than him to examine the evidence? And you can see the URL here to his article about this. I'll just read the bottom line. He says, I do not intend to argue that Sachs's position is reflective of the main trend of rabbinic thought, for it is certainly is not. But as being demonstrated here, it is also a case that some precedent can be found, even for his most radical statements. There is no question that he has gone beyond, should I highlight this? There is no question that he's gone beyond these earlier sources and offered a more complete theory of ecumenism than could possibly have been found in previous generations. One can certainly disagree with it, and I, for one, am not comfortable with many aspects of Sachs's presentation. In particular, his obvious enthrallment with multiculturalism. Yes, by the same token, Haredi assertions that the chief rabbi's comments are a denial of a foundation of Jewish belief also strike me wide of the mark. And if you want to see more, I've given you an article in Tradition here where they also discuss this article and where it fits in. So how are we going to relate to Rabbi Sachs's thesis here? And I want to do two things, and then we'll hopefully have time to. Now, first of all, I'll tell you that Rabbi Sachs, as you can see on your page, what is this, page 7? If you look at page 7, Rabbi Sachs had already expressed the fundamental idea of this book in a book he published in 1991 and a book he published in 1992. So these aren't new ideas of Rabbi Sachs. It was just the way he articulated them. And it struck a very, very negative chord. But I ask a question. By the way, I was lucky enough to have a conversation with Rabbi Sachs very soon after the scandal. I was lucky enough, somebody asked me to give him a ride to a funeral in Israel. And I had 45 minutes with him in the car on the way there and 45 minutes with him in the car on the way back. And we spoke about this at length. And Rabbi Sachs, to me, was adamant that all of his ideas were very, very well rooted in many, many sources. You might be aware, for example, that the Rambam, in a censored passage, censored by the church, in Hilchot Malachim, talks about the idea that even Christianity and Islam have spread certain truths in the world. And that when the Mashiach comes, they'll realize that certain details that Christianity and Islam have are wrong, but the broad thesis, the broad morality that they teach is in accordance with the beliefs of Judaism and with the truth, the divine truth. Rabbi Sachs pointed to that and said, hey, look, don't you see that we're saying there are a lot of truths in Islam and Christianity? But I'd like to go even further back and ask ourselves how much Judaism can accept other religions. And here I want to relate to three very curious quotes, one from Devarim, one from Micha, and one from Malachi. Let's take a look. Devarim here, God's talking about the experience at Har Sinai, the revelation at Mount Sinai. And he says, and maybe you'll look, and he's telling people to be very careful that they didn't see any images there. They never saw any images. And they only heard a voice, and never to represent God in physical form. But then what does Hashem say? What does Moshe say in Devarim? He says, O pentisaynech ha-shamayma, lest you look up to the heavens, v'reita t'shemesh v'tereach, you'll see the sun and the moon and the stars, kol tzva ha-shamayim, all the heavenly hosts, v'nidachta v'shtachavita nahem, v'avaretem, and you'll worship them. And then he says, asher chalak Hashem elokecha otam l'chol ha'amim tachat kol ha-shamayim. These the Lord your God allotted to other peoples under the heavens. What does he mean? I thought it was a problem that the nations served these. Is he saying that, yeah, for Jews, it's wrong to worship idolatry, but for non-Jews, it's not so bad. That's what it sounds like. How about Micha? Micha, many, many, many centuries later, talks about the famous they'll beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. They'll never know war, nation, etc. And each man shall sit on his grapevine or fig tree with no one to disturb him. And then he says, at that messianic time of peace, all the nations will walk each with their own God, V'anachnu nelech b'shem Hashem Elokeinu le'olam va'ed. But we will walk in the name of our God forever and ever. What's the implication of Micha? And even in the Messianic times, nations will follow their religions, but we will follow Hashem. By the way, if you want a little tidbit of information, when Pope John Paul came to visit Israel, I think it was Pope John Paul II came to visit Israel, Rabbi Lau Sr. was the chief rabbi. And he had to give the Pope a gift. What was he going to give? So he gave the Pope a Tanakh, a Koran Tanakh, of course, the Hebrew Bible, and he inscribed it. And what did he inscribe it with? This verse. For all the peoples will walk in the names of its gods, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. Now, on the one hand, this is very nice. This is about religious tolerance. But on the other hand, there is a sort of surreptitious message here, which is, you Christians have been trying to convert us for all of history. It's time to stop. A very brave message to, a very brave verse to inscribe for the Pope. But that is indeed what he inscribed. Whichever way, the implication is that not everybody will necessarily be Jewish in the time of Mashiach. Is there truth to other religions at some level? And Malachi. Malachi is criticizing the Kohanim for the way they serve in the Mikdash. And he says, Ki mizrach shemesh v'ad mevohor gadol shmi bagoyim. From one side, from where the sun rises to where the sun sets, my name is respected amongst the nations. And amongst all the nations, incense, muktar mugash shmi mincha torah. People are bringing sacrifices to me. Ki gadol shmi bagoyim. My name is honored amongst the nations, said the Lord of hosts, but not amongst Israel. So what are we trying to say here? Are we trying to say that indeed there are psukim which lead in the direction of Rabbi Sacks, that indeed there are multiple truths, that we have our emet, and that is our emet, but other religions maybe also have certain emet? It's not only in these psukim. I'll come back to the source at the bottom of page 8, but if you look at Rav Kook, and by the way, Rabbi Sacks later published a set of sources with something like 150 sources, an amazing document. I think it was over 100 pages long, with different sources backing his perspective here. And here are two that he quoted from Rav Kook. I'll read them with you from Orot. Source number 92. The Holy One, blessed be he, dealt charitably with the world by not putting all the talents in one place, not in any one man, or in any one nation, not in any one country, not in any one generation, or in any one world, but the talents are scattered. The store of the special treasure of the world is laid up in Israel. Indeed, otzar skulata olamim b'Yisrael uganus aval kadei la'ached b'muvan haklali. But in order, in a general sense, to unite the world with them, certain talents have been absent from Israel, so they may be completed by the rest of the world and the princes of the nations. Or, again, in olat raya, what does he say? Omnam kolamim yesh kol echad meim matara utuda. Each people has its own purpose and destiny, which constitutes its distinctive vocation and contribution to the perfection of the world. Each nation, through its character and attributes, ideas and history, has something unique which it bestows on humanity as a whole. So this isn't necessarily talking about religious truth. This might be talking about other things. I will say, by the way, Rav Kook has this very interesting view which accords with Rabbi Sacks' view. Rav Kook in Arpele Tohar talks about the idea that in this world we have Kodesh and Chol. We have sacred and profane. But in God's world, everything is Kodesh, Kodashim. Everything is holy. Everything is holy in this world. It's like Rabbi Soloveitchik says, in this world there is order and chaos. We look at one as bad and one as good, but he says both were created by God. If we believe that God created everything, God created everything. In which case, this goes very sharply to what Rabbi Sacks says. There is one God, but there are many, many different manifestations in this world. And at some point, everything is a manifestation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In this way, Rabbi Sacks created a dignity of difference. The idea that we don't want everybody to be the same. We have to respect that there is a spark of godliness in everybody else. And the religion says, so what we need to do is not negate everybody else because everybody else has some godliness, but instead we have to amplify what we've got because that's our tradition, that's our language, that's our God-given message to the world. And therefore, I come to the last segment of what I want to say, and it's this. And let's take a look. There is no contrast. I'm on page nine. He says, and this is in different writings, there is no contradiction, not even a conflict between contributing to humanity and affirming our distinctive identity. To the contrary, by being what only we are, we contribute to the world what only we can give. And now I come to the internal message that Rabbi Sacks spoke about. Rabbi Sacks, and I've seen this in several speeches of his, said that we Jews have a big problem. Again, why be Jewish, says Rabbi Sacks. Some people will say, if you look at the Pew Report, right? If you look at the Pew Report, Rabbi Sacks says that different people say there are all different reasons for Judaism because of the family. Rabbi Sacks says you can get family elsewhere because it makes you ethical. You can get ethics from other sources, he says, because of Jewish food. That certainly you can get from other places, right? Because of Jewish humor. You can get that from other places too. You don't need to be Jewish in order to get Jewish humor. Why be Jewish? Right? He says, we have another problem with that because we live in a world of universalism. We live in a world of political correctness. He says, the only real reason to be Jewish is this: Asher bachar banu mikol amim v'natan lanu et torato, that God chose us and gave us a Torah, and that Torah is our truth. He says, but in today's world, that sounds racial. That sounds supremacist. To modern Jews, says Rabbi Sacks, how do you explain that we have a unique tradition? It goes against everything that we say about the modern world. And Rabbi Sacks says, I racked my brain for 5 years, he says. How can I teach modern Jews that their Judaism is a gift? He says, you know what the answer was? And this is not the external message. This is the internal message. The answer, he said, is the dignity of difference. Everybody has their own truth, but you are a Jew. And the only truth that you have in your heritage, the truth that you were given by God, is your Judaism. And the only way that you can truly impact the world is through your language, through your ability of expression. And therefore, you have to do it through what? Through your Judaism. Take a look at the last sources that I've got on the sheet. I'm going back to sharing. He says, Judaism is not for Jews alone. 1 minute. Judaism is not for Jews alone. If it were, it would make no sense. The God of Abraham is not a tribal God. He's the creator of heaven and earth. The God of Israel is not only the God of Israel. He made human beings in his image. The God of the Hebrew Bible did not limit his blessings to one nation. After the flood, he made a covenant with all humanity. Abraham and his descendants are not the only people in the Bible to encounter God. Abraham's family are not the only moral heroes. So is Pharaoh's daughter. So is Eov, etc. But he says, and this again, Judaism was never meant for Jews alone. It contains a message for all humanity. And much in the 21st century depends on whether this message or a different one prevails. Judaism belongs to the human conversation. And we must take the trouble to share our ideas with others and let others share theirs with us. For a long time, most of history, this was not possible. The world was not interested in what the Jews had to say. Either they were to be converted or assimilated, or they were the other to be reviled. This has changed for two reasons. First, liberal democracies allow space for a multiplicity of voices. We all have a right to speak and to do so in our own person. This is the glory of liberal democracy. Second, because of the existence of the State of Israel, Jews can speak on equal terms. No longer need they be haunted by the trauma of homelessness. And therefore, says Rabbi Sacks, and I'll try again and now summarize the whole class and what we've done today. And I know it was a bit of a whirlwind. Rabbi Sacks starts off and says that religion has been such a source of conflict and that we live in a globalized world, right? And that we're very, very, what is the place of religion in this world when we're talking about universals? And he says that civilization began with lots of different tribes, lots of different, and we're moving towards a global culture, universal culture. But, he says, there's a terrible danger in universalism, and that is one of totalitarianism. It's true about religions who try and convert everybody. It's true about secular ideologies. who want everybody to be communist or want to impose their way of looking at things. And he says that the Torah begins universally because Hashem is related to the whole world, but the danger is of uniformity. And therefore, Hashem divides us into different languages, different cultures, so we should experience the dignity of difference. And therefore, we should appreciate that like Hashem made all the languages, likewise, different faith systems are all reflections. There's a sort of prism whereby Hashem has given a message to different cultures, and there is truth in lots and lots of different places. He was accused of heresy, and we've examined the question, is it indeed heretical? Many people felt it was. However, what I've tried to show is that there are various psukim. The Rabbi Sacks certainly turned to not these psukim necessarily, but turned much more to the Rambam, to Rav Kook, and to others in order to back his views and try and give them credentials. But Rabbi Sacks had this other corollary, which was a message to Jews, and felt that in a world in which one can't talk about the chosen people anymore because it sounds supremacist, the theory of dignity of difference isn't only there to tell us that religions shouldn't hate each other and the religions should see truth in other traditions, but it was even more than that. It would give Jews an understanding that we have a unique message to the world and that it's only our message, right? It's only our message, and that through that message, we should be proud, we should stand tall, because Hashem has given us this idea and only we have it and only we can deliver it. And it has an essential message to civilization as a whole. So this is the dignity of difference, the controversy. And maybe I will finish off with this last text, which I skipped over on the bottom of page 8. Rabbi Sacks wrote this about Rav Soloveitchik. He says, I love this quote. He says, a sober analyst of the history of Jewish philosophy may conclude that its practitioners solved no ultimate problems. Rather, they allowed certain personality types and mental frameworks to take their place in Judaism. The rationalist feels at home because of Maimonides. The anti-rationalist because of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Rav Soloveitchik in his philosophical writings has answered no great questions, but he has done what a great Jewish thinker should. He has given a home to the previously unhoused, to the Jew in the modern world who experiences conflict, loneliness, and the sharp unease of faith. And I might finish off by saying this. I don't know if you have to agree with Rabbi Sacks, but there are a good number of Jews who are looking, they are previously unhoused. They are the Jew in the modern world who believes in tolerance, who believes in universalism, who believes in multiplicity of truths. And until Rabbi Sacks, they didn't have a home. And I would argue that he has given a home to the previously unhoused by phrasing the dignity of difference. I can't even tell you how many people I know who, for them, this is the most important book of Rabbi Sacks, because it allows for a world of difference. It means that Judaism is not a fundamentalistic, intolerant religion, but it is a very pluralistic world. And for this, they are forever grateful for the articulation of Rabbi Sacks. It might not, I don't know, maybe this is the book which will be your favorite Rabbi Sacks book, or maybe you really can't stand this philosophy whatsoever. I haven't even opened the chat, so I have no clue what I'm about to see. But having said that, I do think that this gives voice to a certain philosophy that many, many people in the modern world have been waiting for. And since I think it does have legs to stand on, I think it is an important voice within the kaleidoscope of Jewish thought. So thank you very much. And now we
thank you, Rabbi. Thank you very much. Yes, I love that last quote on the Rav. You know, that's I have not seen that before, really. Thank you very much. Beautiful. Okay, there are a whole bunch of questions. What I'm going to recommend is we spend not more than 6-7 minutes on it, just to be fair to you, to people who sort of to set aside time, 7-8 minutes maximum. And maybe you can pick up on some of the questions at the beginning of next week, if that's okay. But if you don't agree with me, you can overrule me.
No, it's fine. I also, let's keep it short because people, you know.
Yeah. So you want to go through the questions and pick out the ones, or you want
me? You have any that you've seen?
Commenting different gene British Jewry. Okay, that's... Christian. Okay, somebody's asking, what about other religions besides what about Buddhism, Hinduism, which may be sort of a little bit more quote unquote idolatrous.
Right. So I definitely think that Rabbi Sacks is not saying that every religion has all the truth. And in that regard, he really probably did feel that his, to say that in Christianity, and by the way, there are books where Rabbi Sacks takes Christianity to task terribly, right? I've actually been shocked in some of his books where he bashes Christianity. Oh my goodness. In his book called The Great Partnership, he has a whole segment where he really, really, has very negative things to say about Christianity. So clearly he didn't think that those religions were necessarily all true. And I assume this, the Avodah Zarah aspect of Christianity, of God incarnate, bothered him in Christianity and Kal Vachomer and other religions. I find it difficult to believe that he was giving a hechsher to other religions for those people. But I think he was saying that there are truths there. I see one from Stephen Zeitchik. How do Rabbi Sacks reconcile his belief in Judaism, love of particularities and divergencies, with the necessarily homogeneity of orthodoxy, etc., etc.? I want to say something about Rabbi Sacks. Rabbi Sacks had an unusual biography. He didn't grow up in the cookie-cutter world of orthodoxy. He went to non-Jewish schools. He certainly didn't go to yeshiva university. He didn't even spend much time in a yeshiva. Certainly when he was in yeshiva for a while, but then didn't remain there for very long. And he really was his own man. In fact, if I can maybe quote his predecessor, Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz. Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz once said something really interesting. He said that the Haredi world are obsessed that we should produce gedolim. And he said once in a speech, he said, I've got news for you, the Haredi world are not going to produce gedolim. And we said to him, Rabbi Jacobowitz, why? He said, because all the gedolim of Eastern Europe had a unique education. They went and learned with this Rebbe for a few years and that Rebbe for a few years. And this Rebbe was a bit eclectic and that Rebbe was unique. He says, but now we all learn in mass institutions. And he says, factory produces a factory line. They don't produce uniqueness. They don't produce unique fusions. I find it so interesting, for example, that so many of the gedolim of the last century were all immigrants. They were all translating their culture from Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, immigrating from Egypt to Israel, to Rabbi Soloveitchik, to Lubavitcher Rebbe, to Rav Aaron Kotler, to, they were all immigrants, right? They all had to Rabbi Heschel. They were all translating their Eastern European experience to an American experience, their this experience to that. They had to break it and remake it. Okay, they had to, and that created their genius. Rabbi Sacks really understood the diversity of the Jewish world, and he saw the good in every single group. He had a lot of love for Chabad, but didn't sanction everything they did. He saw the good in the, you know, in the modern Orthodox community. He couldn't always put his backing behind the Limud conference, but he did back them in private, etc., etc., etc. So I think he did see a diversity. He wasn't looking for a monolithic uniformity in Orthodoxy, and he appreciated the diversity within Orthodoxy.
Just one other, perhaps, just to throw it, I think, to back up Rabbi Sacks, pointing out that our attitude not to accept converts, and initially would seem to indicate that they have, you know, that the observances they practice have to be acceptable, because otherwise, you know, why wouldn't we want them if we feel everybody else is wrong? The fact that we say no, you know, so... I don't know if you want to comment on that, or how to tell you, maybe that's because only Shavuot Mitzvah, but they know. I know that's not necessarily talking about other religion, but still.
Well, I'll comment on the comment where somebody says, where somebody wrote, I don't know who it is because he didn't put a name, but he says, Rambam says that much of halacha was discoverable by people, especially between man and man. And indeed, the Rambam does say that, but the Rambam divides mitzvot into two, right? He says there are mitzvot sichliot. There are mitzvot which are intuitive, let's call it, which we could come up with. And there are mitzvot shimiot. There are some mitzvot which we would only get from tradition. An interesting question, which we feel, which. So there, almost any orthodoxy is always going to have some aspect of religion which relies on intuition, logic, you know, ethics, and the other which relies purely on revelation. I think those are two pillars, according to almost any theology of Judaism.
Okay. I think unless there's something you really want to take, we'll pick up next week.
That's great.
And I
next
want to thank you.
Next time, Bezrat Hashem, we are going to read together passages from the book, The Letter in the Scroll. It was published in England under a different name, Radical Then, Radical Now. And it's really Rabbi Sachs's book, which is Why Be Jewish? What does it mean to be a Jew? In fact, we will see a few videos next week, and it will end off with a video, which is I Am a Jew Because, which is actually the last chapter of his book. It's the conclusion of his book. So this is going, if today was about universalism and diversity, universalism and particularism, next time will be very much the Jewish story, Why Be Jewish? So see you all next week. Thank you very much. Have a great week.
Shabbat. Thank you, Rabbi. We'll look forward to seeing you next week. And this evening, Dr. Mark Shapiro, in case you don't know, every Monday evening at 8:30 p.m., it's 3:30 in Israel, so I understand you don't know. He'll be actually finishing the 53rd class in his ongoing series on his book. He thought he might finish last week. We knew he would take 2 weeks to the letters to rabbinic figures from across the world. Talk on diversity. Universal, really, the rabbis from across the entire spectrum, pretty much, at least within the Orthodox spectrum, he'll be discussing the letters he did not include in the book. After he finishes the book, we're going to take a couple weeks, then talking about beyond the Orthodox spectrum, sort of, maybe. He'll be giving a series on Shaul Lieberman, back to the series where we have over 200 lectures on great rabbinic figures that he's been giving for many, many years on Torah Motion. So it's cute that you mention him. Tomorrow morning, Rachel Sharansky Danziger will be continuing her series on storytelling and kings. Wednesday, Simi Peters continuing on Yirmiyahu, and then Moshe Sokolov in the evening on the Haftorah of the week. Thursday morning, Shuli Mishkin on her tours of Israel. And Thursday night, this week, the Parsha Shir by Yossi Levine, Rabbi Yossi Levine, the rabbi of the Jewish Center in Manhattan, and Friday morning, my shir in Pirkei Avot, Friday morning, and then Sunday morning, Rabbi Liebtag, and we'll see you, please God, next week for Rabbi Israel at 12:15 or 7:15 in Israel, Erev Tov, and everybody be well, and then, as I mentioned at the beginning, our Medical Ethics Conference, Sunday, July 11th, that's basically 7 hours, has medical credits for those who are medical doctors would like credits, but even if you're not doctors, fascinating stuff. So that'll be Sunday, July 11th. And we look forward to learning with you and seeing with you. And like I always say, there are a lot of people who are still here. Invite a friend. That's our best form of having people come and join us for learning. If you liked it, share it with somebody. If you have a criticism, let me know and we can try and correct it. Okay, everybody have a wonderful day, and we look forward to seeing you, those who can make it this evening, and whenever you can make it. Thank you very much. Be well, everybody. Be safe, be well. Thank you.